This is Science Friday. I'm John Dankosky. Ira Flatow is away. Advances in electronics and biomedical technology are taking phrases that sound like something out of science fiction and beginning to make them possible. Gene editing, brain chips, synthetic blood. And while many people accept research into those technologies to cure a disease or treat a condition, those same technologies have the potential to add capabilities to a human being. Extra height, extra endurance, better reaction time. A new survey published this week finds that many Americans don't think that this is a good idea. But what do you think? If given the opportunity to make yourself smarter with a brain chip, would you do it? Our number is 844-724-8255. That's 844-SCI-TALK. You can always tweet us at SciFry. You can join us there anytime. Again, 844-724-8255. Let me bring in our guest. Carrie Funk is Associate Director of Research at the Pew Research Center in Washington. She's co-author on the report, which was issued this week. Welcome, Carrie.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, you looked at three technologies, gene editing, brain chips, and artificial blood. Do people that you talk to look at these three technologies the same way?
That's one of the surprises here, is that even though these are three very different technologies and they're used in different ways, the contours of public opinion were quite similar across the three. You know, overall, we're seeing Americans largely cautious about using these emerging technologies in ways that would push human capacities beyond what's been possible before.
So is there a difference in attitude between people on the technology itself or whether they'd use it on themselves? So it's one thing to have it as an idea that someone could use, another thing to say, would I put a chip in my head?
That's right. I mean, you know, obviously this is these are difficult concepts to get across in a public opinion survey. It's complex technology. They're emerging technologies. They're not readily available right now. They're available only in very limited circumstances right now for therapeutic needs. So what this does is give us an early look at public opinion about using these cutting-edge technologies to boost human abilities. And what we see are some similar patterns in terms of people being more worried than enthusiastic about each of them. And we also see that people, when you talk about the possibility of making more dramatic changes to human abilities, that tends to be less acceptable. Let me give you just one example of that from the brain chip implant. If those abilities would be equal to one's peak cognitive abilities now, then about half of Americans say that would be an appropriate use of the technology. But far fewer, about 3 in 10, say the same if the resulting abilities would be far above that of any human known to date.
So that seems really non-intuitive, right? You would put in a brain chip, you'd go to the trouble of all this, and it would just make me as smart as I normally am on my smartest day versus it would make me Albert Einstein. But people are actually more scared of the Einstein chip?
So, yes, it is, I guess, a bit counterintuitive. So for all the potential appeal of having sharper brains and being stronger and healthier, you know, that's part of the surprise here, is that you do see Americans largely cautious about using these technologies in this way.
Of course, there's the technologies like a chip in your brain or artificial blood, which I might choose to take myself. Gene editing, though, has to do with what might happen with our children. That's sort of a different question, isn't it?
Well, it is a little bit different. You know, human enhancement is a very broad idea, and it's a term used mostly by ethicists. So in simple terms, it's making biochemical or surgical changes to improve our cognitive abilities, our physical abilities, and that includes our health. Now, on the other hand, as you say, you know, gene editing to reduce a baby's risk of disease. Now, we did talk about a healthy baby, not a baby who has a serious condition that we're trying to remedy, is obviously the most closely linked with that idea of medical and therapeutic needs. And so to the extent we saw differences across the three, we do see opinion about gene editing being a little more positive or a little less wary, if you would. Public's more divided about whether or not they would want gene editing for their baby. And more say there'd be net benefits for society than downsides.
You found some interesting results around gender and around religion. Can you talk about that?
Sure. You know, one of the strongest divides in public opinion actually is along religious lines. So people who are more religious, in this case, you know, is a phrase used to mean across religious faiths, people who say religion is very important in their lives or are more practicing in terms of prayer and attending service. Those folks tended to be much more negative, concerned about these kinds of enhancements. They're more likely to see these different techniques as meddling with nature and crossing a line that should not be crossed.
Martin in Gainesville, Florida, actually has a question I wanted to ask. Hi, Martin. Go ahead. You're on Science Friday.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call. Like so many other new things that are going to be amazing developments, they're going to be costly. And so my question has to do with whether or not this is going to create a sort of a new class warfare of haves and have-nots of technological enhancement. Whether you've got the resources to do it or not, is this going to be available to all, or is it going to be something that's going to create a sort of a group of those that have it and those that simply can't get it?
Boy, it's a really great question, Martin, and thank you for that. And Carrie Funk, is that something that you asked about?
Right. I mean, I can't predict what will happen, but you're raising a point that many people think will happen, which is we did ask about different things people thought would occur because of these techniques. And about 7 in 10 said more inequality would occur because these would only be available for the wealthy, at least initially.
Yeah, and I wonder, are there any economic splits on your study? Because, you know, some people might think, my goodness, it would help me get ahead in life. Other people have much of what they already need.
Right, and that's one of those surprises. So, you know, though many people saw more social inequality occurring, there were not strong differences by education or income or by race, ethnicity. You mentioned earlier there are some other tendencies between men and women, where men tend to be a little more accepting of these technologies than women. But beyond that, not so many other differences.
You mentioned earlier the question of therapeutic needs. I mean, I don't think there's a whole lot of people who question the notion that we'd use the latest technology to heal someone who is sick. But we're talking about something very different here. How do people feel about new technologies that will help fix a broken body versus somebody who's functioning perfectly well, then adding something to make themselves even better?
Right, and that's an idea that also came up in the focus groups. In order to get at these concepts, the first thing we did was talk with people in small groups and get a sense of how they were thinking about these issues. And we heard in those discussions very clearly that when this was something for a medical or therapeutic need, then that was no problem. But they were questioning the kind of the necessity of doing these kinds of things for healthy people.
John is calling from Avon, Connecticut. Hi, John.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What's up?
So one of the things that I just wanted to comment on is I work for the United States Navy, and one of the things that we do is we're really the forefront of using technology to bring
the
United States has. Say again?
Oh, I think our guest just said she couldn't hear you for a second there. Maybe I'll put you on hold, John, and maybe finish out your question. Can you hear me, Carrie? Hi, Carrie Funk, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, good. John from Avon, Connecticut was just asking a question about the military, the idea that there's going to be some people who probably will be on the front edge of this technology, more so than others. Did you look at all into how these technologies might be developed or who they might be used with? Because one might think that if you're trying to enhance humans, the military would be at the forefront of this.
Right. I mean, these ideas are being talked about because of the potential for these developing technologies to be used more broadly. So certainly right now they're more being developed for particular needs, but this idea is one that we wanted to get at in terms of broader innovation. So this is really part of our more ongoing effort to look at the emerging technologies and how and what kinds of ethical and social implications they might bring.
Of course, we've had something called cosmetic surgery around for a very long time, and people have for years been trying to change their appearance. Do people's opinions around human enhancement run along the same lines as their thoughts about cosmetic surgery? It's a type of enhancement in its own right.
Yes. So, this is one of these ideas that comes up a lot in terms of whether familiarity with these techniques is part of what's going on. So just as a point of comparison, the Pew Research Study also looked at public thinking about a handful of current enhancements that are widely available now. As you mentioned, some are cosmetic procedures and others are not. And as you might expect, public views tend to be more positive overall about these procedures, but we also see some mixed reaction to today's enhancements. I'll give you just one or two examples. In a very general question, we find that roughly 6 in 10 Americans say people are too quick to undergo cosmetic procedures to change their appearance in ways that are not really important.
We had a presidential candidate just this week say, I believe in science, and get a big cheer. I'm wondering how you feel like these findings fit in with people's overall thoughts about science and discovery right now in America.
Right. I think it's really important to keep in mind that the general public tends to hold positive views about the effect of science and technology on society. And in the very same survey, we find 2/3 of adults saying science has had mostly positive effects. And biomedical contributions are one of the most important reasons given for that point of view. So, you know, while there are a number of concerns that we're looking that we uncovered in the survey, we also find that kind of, positive effect of science. We also see expectations for continued innovation to occur in the future. So roughly half of adults think the idea of an implanted computer chip is likely to be routine occurrence within the next 50 years. About that many, 47%, foresees a future with almost no birth defects because of genetic modification of embryos. So we see that a lot in surveys about science. There's broadly positive views, and often the public's optimistic about continued innovation.
They're optimistic, and do they get more optimistic as they learn more, as they find out more about what science is possible and what's on the horizon, they get more optimistic about it?
That's a tricky question. So, you know, certainly people who right now have heard more about these ideas tended to be more positive about them, more likely to want each of these enhancements for themselves or for their baby. And we'll have to see down the road whether that holds. It could be that these are people who are just staying abreast of science and technology and they're also more enthusiastic, or it could be that as people become more familiar, they become more accepting.
Carrie Funk is Associate Director of Research at the Pew Research Center in Washington. Carrie, thanks so much for joining us and bringing us these interesting studies.
My pleasure.
When we come back, a creative way to combat a deadly disease that is transmitted by snails. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm John Dankosky. Thanks to popular depictions in Hollywood and television, sharks may be one of the world's scariest creatures to many of us, but they're certainly not the most deadly. That title belongs to mosquitoes, which can transmit diseases that cause over 750,000 deaths a year. But right below mosquitoes on that list, the humble freshwater snail. They can carry a disease that we rarely hear about in the U.S. It's called schistosomiasis. It affects nearly 250 million people, mostly in Africa, Asia, and South America. So far, drug treatments have only been able to curb the epidemic by around 40%. Now, a couple of Stanford researchers have discovered that fighting the disease ecologically, that is by introducing a predator to the environment, can be more effective than modern medicine. Here to talk about the findings is Susanna Sokolow, who is a research associate in biology at Stanford University. Welcome to the program. Thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
So most people will be surprised to hear, first of all, that freshwater snails are one of the world's deadliest creatures because of this parasite. Talk about schistosomiasis and why we don't hear about it more in the U.S.
Sure thing. Yeah, so schistosomiasis, as you said, is a waterborne parasitic infection carried by snails. It's particular species of snails that are distributed pretty widely in the world throughout the tropics, but mostly in the developing world. So as you mentioned, you know, these snails are not found in the U.S., on the continental U.S. anyway. So, of course, we don't have the disease here, and people may have not heard of it. That doesn't change the fact that it's one of the world's most deadly parasites. You do contract it from just wading, swimming, you know, entering the water in any way, and the parasites basically exit the snails into the water and seek you, and they penetrate right through your skin, migrate through your body, end up in your blood vessels where they can live for many years, even decades. It's not the worms that actually cause disease to people, it's the eggs. So the worms do mature into, they're about a centimeter long, and they live there and lay hundreds to thousands of eggs a day. And those eggs have sharp barbs because they eventually need to make it back out of the human body and back into the water and find their snails that they need to complete their reproduction cycle. And so those eggs can lodge in different tissues and cause severe symptoms, all the way ranging from, you know, anemia and fatigue, all the way to very severe symptoms, even death in about 10% of chronic cases.
Oh, it sounds just horrifying. So how have we treated this terrible disease in the past?
Yeah, so about 40 years ago, we you know, discovered and it hit the market, a brand new drug that carried a lot of promise. It is a fantastic drug called praziquantel, kind of a mouthful, but it's it does a great job of clearing the parasites out of infected people. The problem is it's really short-acting and short-lived, and people can head right back out in the water the next day, especially in developing countries where they're really dependent on these freshwater lakes and rivers for their everyday life, for washing dishes and, you know, bathing their animals and all their daily activities. So they're back out in the water the very next day and reinfected. So, you know, we suspect that this might be, you know, part of the picture why, you know, the drugs themselves, while they're very, very important as, you know, access to medical care for individuals who are infected, they really haven't made a big dent in the global burden yet.
And that's one of the things that happens, right? If there's a drug that comes along, maybe we don't treat the other parts of the problem quite as well. So what are we looking at here now? Just getting rid of the snails altogether, that will help to curb this problem.
Sure, yeah. So it's actually not required to get rid of the snails altogether. You just have to address both sides of this transmission picture. So we have the people who, you know, have the worms in their system, are suffering from that. We absolutely need to treat them with this, you know, these great drugs. But we also have the environmental component of this cycle, and we can't lose sight of that. And I think with the promise of this new drug, you know, maybe as a global health community, we did lose sight of that a little bit. And you know, we were very, very creative. We've really been fighting this disease in many countries around the world for at least the last century. In fact, records date back to ancient Egypt. So we've been fighting this disease for a very long time. And before the drug was available, we were using really creative strategies. So, for example, Japan eliminated the disease in the late 1970s, pretty much exclusively focusing on you know, creative engineering solutions to reduce snail habitat. The snails have not disappeared from Japan, even to today, but the parasite did, because we addressed, you know, medical care for the people in combination with creative strategies to reduce the snails. And it's that integrated strategy, I think, that, you know, is what we've seen time and again in our historical look at the past 100 years of control for this parasite, that, you know, that has really worked.
So tell us some specifics of the findings of your study.
So we studied 83 countries and semi-autonomous territories around the world for the last century that have been combating this disease, which is, you know, a very long history. And we were able to gather data for most of those. And we essentially found that, you know, of the two main strategies, the one focused on the people and the drug treatments, usually today administered through what's called mass drug administration, so just distributing drugs to at-risk populations without, not through hospitals necessarily, but through programs. And the other being the environmental component or the snail control component, and sometimes a combination. And we found that among the programs that used the snail control, there was a 90% on average reduction in the long term of the prevalence of this disease. And in the programs that focused so far solely or primarily on distributing drugs through these mass drug administrations, there was a little less than on average a 40% reduction. So a big difference.
So what exactly does snail control look like? What do you do?
So that's, you know, that's a great question and one that we're really interested in. I mean, so in the past, there's been a number of strategies. I mentioned Japan with their engineering. So they did things like reduce snail habitat through lining their irrigation canals, which are great snail habitat, with cement, and building bridges so people didn't have to contact the water. Other countries have used creative, more biological solutions, like introducing snails that compete with the snails that carry schistosomiasis but that are not susceptible. And those, you know, drive the schistosomiasis snails populations down. And there's potentially many other strategies. One that, you know, we don't really favor, even though was used in the past, was chemical molluscicides or snail poisons. They have a lot of environmental impacts other than killing snails. And they were effective, of course, in the past. But I think, you know, at this point, what we're advocating is that, you know, we spend a lot of, you know, time and energy and money researching in the biomedical realm new drugs and you know, vaccines and those kind of things. They're fantastic. They're going to save lots of lives. But How many lives can we save by innovating and being creative in ways to control and reduce snail populations or other, you know, environmental interventions for other diseases that, you know, are passed in some way through environmental hosts or reservoirs? You know, one avenue, sort of creative avenue we're looking at now is reintroduction of snail predators. It hasn't been used much in the past, but in particular, in an area in Senegal in West Africa, we're working with a local nonprofit called EPLS. And, you know, we've been working there for about 5 years trying to investigate how the environment has been changed by human activities and has driven away a predator, these native prawns that, you know, are real voracious predators of the snails, and how we might bring them back through creative engineering, building ladders over dams so that prawns can access these sites that they're now eradicated from, or even using aquaculture, you know, growing the prawns on purpose for, you know, to reduce the snail populations and help synergize with the medical interventions to help curb this disease there. We don't have results yet. You know, it'll be a couple of years, but check back.
I was going to say, any worries about introducing predators and giving them the upper hand in something like this?
Sure, that's a great question. And, you know, of course, as an ecologist and as a team of ecologists and epidemiologists and medical doctors, you know, we're looking at every angle. But, you know, we're talking about real human lives here. We're talking about a lot of suffering. In fact, the vast majority of people suffering from schistosomiasis is children, young children and young adults. And, you know, we have to balance all of those risks with the benefits. Mm-hmm. And here, you know, we're really talking about restoring a system, studying that system, finding those ecological levers, we like to call them, that have been pushed by human activity and pushing them back so that they're back in balance. And really, you know, all human activity has some risk, but I think if we do things well and do things smartly, we can reap the benefits. So,
Susanna Sokolow is a research assistant in biology at Stanford University. She joined us today from KAZU in Monterey. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Twenty years ago, scientists awaited the birth of an animal that was the first of its kind. Dolly the sheep was born in Edinburgh, Scotland. She was the first mammal clone from an adult cell. Dolly lived until nearly 7 years old, not too bad for a sheep. 2 years before her death, though, she developed osteoarthritis, and when researchers examined her chromosomes, they found that she had shortened telomeres, a possible sign that her DNA was older than her actual biological age. This week, another team of scientists published a study that looked at the health of Dolly's sister clones, four sheep that were created from the same cell line. My next guest is here to tell us how that checkup went. Kevin Sinclair is an author on that paper. He's also a professor of developmental biology at the University of Nottingham in Nottingham, England. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, John. Good to be here.
So, first of all, these sheep were created from the same cell line. You've called them sister clones. Are they exact replicas of Dolly?
So they're what we would call genomic copies, John. They share the same nuclear DNA. They're the same cell line, the same batch of cells, in fact, that gave rise to Dolly. But of course, the eggs in which the nuclei from these cells are injected are from different donors, from different animals. And so they share the same nuclear DNA, but they don't share the same mitochondrial DNA. So that's true for all clones generated by somatic cell nuclear transfer, and that's why we refer to them as being genomic copies rather than as purely identical.
So these four clone sheep are now 9 years old. Sheep usually live 10, 12 years old or so?
Yeah, it's possible. Do you know, it's kind of like humans. It's difficult to do a direct age comparison, but as a rough rule of thumb, you could say one sheep year is equal to eight human years. And of course, humans are capable of living into their 70s and 80s and beyond, but few actually do that. These animals are probably now, at 9 years of old, they're probably around about the 70-year mark.
And so how's their physical health?
The physical health is very good, as you probably could see from the pictures that have been circulated and also the video. They're out every summer. They're out in a paddock, and they will bring them in during the barn. One of the clones, her name is Debbie. We when we undertook MRI and X-rays last year, she showed the most radiographic evidence of the most advanced osteoarthritis, but she was showing no clinical signs last year. But in June this year, just a month or so ago, we started to notice that she was getting a little stiff in the morning. So we've since been giving her a little medication from day to, you know, not every day, but occasionally through her diet.
So overall, their health is better than Dolly's health was. I mean, Dolly, of course, didn't make it to 9 years old.
As far as we can ascertain, that's probably true. I mean, Dolly, I mean, the only thing that we could say about Dolly was that she developed osteoarthritis at a younger age than these animals, and started to show clinical signs at a younger age than these animals. I mean, Dolly died, unfortunately, because she just picked up a virus that causes lung tumors. It's prevalent throughout the world, and its prevalence in the UK is quite low. And so she and other members of the flock were really unlucky to have picked up that virus, and that was the reason for her early demise.
I'm John Dankosky, and this is Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. We're talking with Kevin Sinclair, who's a professor of developmental biology at the University of Nottingham in Nottingham, England, about sister clones of Dolly the sheep. So Dolly was a success, but it took about 300 attempts or so to get there. How has cloning technology changed over the course of the last 20 years?
So it's moved a long way, in fact. Modern protocols now for cloning animals are much more efficient than they were at the time that Dolly was created. And the level of research isn't as great as it once was, because, you know, if you were to think about what was cloning's greatest legacy, it probably was, you know, it demonstrated for the first time that you could induce what we call pluripotency in cells. You could take a terminally differentiated cell and restore it to something akin to an embryonic cell, which is capable of dividing into many cell types. And that was the impetus for scientists to look at ways of trying to do that in the laboratory, and that led to the a discovery that you could induce cells to become pluripotent by using a small number of genes, and so-called induced pluripotent cells, stem cells, is really what's taken off since. So cloning is still undertaken, particularly in the United States, and the protocols being used today are much more efficient and much more effective. So we can be hopeful with the research that's taking place that in the future we could maybe see more healthy cloned animals like this.
So what do these healthy cloned animals tell us about what cloning might do for us? I mean, we've been thinking about cloning and its use in human medicine for years. Do the next 20 years bring something in which cloning actually helps us live longer, be healthier?
So, as I said, the field has kind of moved a little bit away from cloning in some respects towards these iPS cells, and I think that's where most of the activity is likely to be in future. There are two or three labs that are cloning human embryos with a view of generating human embryonic stem cells for therapeutic purposes, and it's evident that that process is actually really quite effective in inducing pluripotency. What this particular study shows us, however, is that there's a population of cells that quite clearly undergo, for all intents and purposes, almost complete reprogramming to produce normal embryos, which give rise to normal pregnancies, and then normal offspring, which can live a long time. And so where there are some cells that can undergo effectively complete reprogramming, and that gives us hope that in the future, as we refine our techniques, that we can expect a much larger population of these cells, and so that we can use either cloning or iPS cell technology with more confidence that we produce cells which are effective and also safe for use.
I just have one last quick question for you. Are there more Dollies coming from this line of sheep?
No, it's not likely that there will be. I mean, this is an opportunity. My former colleague Keith Campbell, who passed away in 2012, he was interested in evaluating his protocols to go back to the original line and to see how far things had progressed. It's likely in the future that we're going to move forward with the other cell lines.
Kevin Sinclair is a professor of developmental biology at the University of Nottingham in Nottingham, England. Thank you so much for joining us, sir.
Welcome.
When we come back, let your porch light shine. Moth Week. Yes, very excited. It's Moth Week here on Science Friday. This is Science Friday. I'm John Dankosky, sitting in for Ira Flatow. I know you've had your calendar marked for quite some time. The cake has been ordered, the decorations hung, the porch light has been lit for your annual Moth Week celebration. We're in the middle of the 5th annual National Moth Week, and here to guide us in our celebration is one of the co-founders of the National Moth Week Observance. Elena Tartaglia is assistant professor of biology at Bergen Community College in Paramus, New Jersey. Welcome back to the show, and happy Moth Week to you.
Thanks, John.
I'm really glad you're here. So we got a lot of moth questions, and if you have a question for us, 844-724-8255. That's 844-SCI-TALK. Maybe if you have a favorite moth, or if you're a moth aficionado. A question I'm sure you get a lot is, what's the difference between a moth and a butterfly?
That's a great question, and one that I really never get tired of answering. So from a taxonomic perspective, there really isn't a difference. This just speaks to our need as humans to classify things as either or. But there are a couple differences. If you're looking at an insect and you really need to know, is this a moth or a butterfly? The easiest thing to do is to look at the antennae. So butterflies have a little spoon-shaped antennae. It kind of looks like a Q-tip on the end. And moth antennae are pretty variable. So some of them have straight antennae, and a lot of the males of many species have these beautiful, long, feathery antennae. So that's one of the easiest ways to tell. And then the other almost foolproof method is that butterflies are all diurnal, so every butterfly is out during the day. There's no nighttime butterflies. So if you're looking at a lepidopteran in the daytime, it's probably a butterfly. There are a few moth species in the day, and if you're looking at a lepidopteran at night, you know it's a moth.
Ah, okay. So you love moths. A lot of people, yeah, can take moths or leave moths. So give us a pep talk about moths. Why should we care about them so much?
Well, moths are really important in ecosystems. And number one, they act as pollinators. So they aid in plant reproduction. And especially in the American Southwest, they're a very important suite of pollinators there. And they actually can carry pollen for very far distances. So bees are great pollinators. Other insects are great pollinators. Moths don't actually return to a nest at night. So they have the potential to carry pollen pretty far distances, which is really good for plant genetics because it can outcross a little farther. And additionally, moths are important parts of food webs. So they provide food for birds, for bats, as well as some mammals as in addition.
You're talking about them and their role as pollinators. We've been worried about the bees and bee colonies. We've been worried about monarch butterflies, mm-hmm. whether or not they're getting enough food to make their migrations. Do we have worries about moths right now?
Yeah, unfortunately, we do see declines in some species. So moths aren't quite as well studied, and that is one of the goals of National Moth Week, is to look at moth populations. But they're not as well studied, but we are seeing declines in some species of moths, unfortunately. And a lot of that is down to, with a lot of conservation, you see habitat loss as the main factor in declines.
Why did you start studying moths?
That's also a really great question. I was working on my dissertation, and I wanted to study pollination in urban environments. And when you do a dissertation, you have to carve out your own little special niche. And not very many people in my area were studying that. And I saw a professor give a talk on moth pollination, and I was just fascinated. And so I started to look into moth abundance and diversity and pollination in urban environments in New York and New Jersey.
And it hooked you.
It really did. And so I started going to these moth nights in East Brunswick, and that's how Moth Week actually got started, just a couple of us going mothing in East Brunswick. And we thought, wouldn't it be fun to get everyone in New Jersey to do a moth night? And then as the night progressed, we just thought, wouldn't it be fun to get the whole U.S.? And then we thought, why not get the world? And we put it on social media, and we had interest all over the place, surprisingly. And now we have events. I think we have over 450 events in 42 countries this year.
Wait, how do you go mothing? What does mothing consist of?
So mothing is really easy. You need no special equipment. You can get special equipment, but all you need to do is set out a light. Now, I have a really strong full-spectrum mercury vapor bulb, but if you have ever come home late at night, you know that moths will fly to any porch light. So all you have to do is set out a light or turn on your porch light and then wait for them to come. And if you don't feel like sitting out all night, you can leave the light on all night and come out in the morning and you'll see what you got.
You know what my next question is, though. Why do they go to the light? Why are they always flickering around the light whenever I come home at night?
Yeah, so that's another question that, you know, as scientists, we can't ask a moth why it's flying to a light. So we have the best hypothesis is that moths actually, and other nocturnal creatures, actually navigate by guiding themselves to the brightest object in the night sky. Now, normally that's the moon, But when an entomologist puts out a moth light, that automatically now becomes the brightest object in the sky, and the moths will navigate towards that. Now, of course, it's not the moon. So once they get there, they're kind of dazzled by that bright light, and they go into their torpor, their sleep mode.
I want to get to a call here. Daniel is calling from Tacoma Park, Maryland. Hi, Daniel. What's your question?
Yeah, so every time you watch a cartoon and you see a cartoonist basically opening their closet, you see it like the moths fly out, and like they always go after the clothing. So why do moths eat clothing, and what is about it that attracts them to that?
Well, thank you very much for the question. Okay, do moths eat clothing, first of all, or is this a cartoon fantasy?
No, they do. Just a couple of them.
Oh, okay.
So not every moth, and not even most moths. Just a couple of moths will eat clothing, and they're attracted to the natural fibers. And so they're eating your wool sweaters and sometimes silks as well. So they're attracted to the natural fibers, and you can get rid of them by putting your clothes in the freezer if you have a moth infestation problem.
Hold it. You're putting your clothes in the freezer?
Yeah, that'll kill them.
Okay, so I don't know if I put all my clothes in the freezer if they'd all fit in there. Well, I want to talk about some of the moths that you brought in for us, and you have
sure.
a beautiful display here. I know that you selected one type of moth for special attention this year. Maybe you could point this out to me. What do you have?
Yeah, so we are doing the underwings this year. So for the past few years, National Moth Week, we've been highlighting a certain group, and this year we chose the underwings. And most underwings are in this genus called Catocala, which actually in Greek means beautiful underwing. And they are cryptic on the top, so when their wings are folded, they blend in with bark. And then when they are startled by a predator, their defense is to open their forewings, and their hind wings have these beautiful bright colors on them. And so it's the best hypothesis we have is that is to startle away their predators, which are some nocturnal birds.
Oh, interesting. So that's what the underwings are.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see them there. One of the things that's always fascinated me about moths is sometimes the camouflage, sometimes the gigantic eyes that mm-hmm. you'll see that will make it look like it's a bird or something else. What are some of the more amazing moth species that do something that we just probably couldn't have thought up ourselves? I mean, they do have some fairly unique patterns.
Yeah, so a couple of the other species that we actually have in this area, in the New York, New Jersey area, one of them is the Io moth. That one has the best eye spots to my knowledge. And so yeah, they can do that startle defense, and they can look like the predators of their predators. And so once they open their wings, their predator is startled because they think they're about to get eaten, perhaps.
Ah, okay. I got another call here. Mm-hmm. John is in Kingsport, Tennessee. Let's get to John. Hi there. You're on Science Friday.
How are you doing today?
Doing well. What's on your mind?
I'm having an invasion problem with pantry moths, and
Uh-oh.
They seem to be able to get into anything that's not glass or something. Is there any material they cannot chew through, and how can you get rid of those little pesky bugs?
John, thank you very much for the phone call. A couple of moth-hating calls so far, Elena. You seem disappointed by this, but this is a problem. I've had pantry moths before, too, so what can you tell John?
That's okay. I've also had pantry moths. So you're doing the right thing by keeping your grains in glass, because they can't get through that, and they can't get through hard plastic. So as soon as you get your grains, do take them and put them into your nice-looking glass containers, which look better in your pantry anyway. And again, if you have problems with moths coming in the grains, you can store them in the freezer for a little bit, and that should take care of the problem. Unfortunately, if you already have a bad infestation, it might be time to start over your little grain pantry.
Yeah, and they really are hard to get rid of.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, are moths considered a pest species? I know there's just so many different types of them. When they chew through your clothes in your closet, or they eat your grains in your pantry, they are. But are they considered or classified a pest species in many places?
Well, you know, there's between 150 and 500,000 species of moth in the world.
So that's a few.
Yeah. So there are a couple that are pests, and unfortunately, those are the ones we interact with a lot. But the vast majority of moths are just neither help nor harm humans. And they don't care about us. We don't care about them. And then, of course, there are the beneficial ones, as I just mentioned, the pollinators, the ones that play important roles in food webs, the ones that we're modeling micro aerial vehicle flight after as well. So some of them can fly amazingly fast and very agile. And there are these tiny little micro aerial vehicles, we call them, that are modeled after the flight of some of these moths.
That's really interesting. I mentioned the monarch butterflies and their long migration. Do any moth species do something like this, long migrations over long distances?
Yeah, so moths actually can migrate long distances. I don't actually know the exact figures on that. And some of them can fly up to a couple of kilometers in one night. So a lot of them are quite long distance flyers.
And if you have questions, 844-724-8255. That's 844-SCI-TALK. Questions about moths or perhaps favorite moths. In this display that you brought me, there's one in the upper right-hand corner here. And you see, it's gigantic. It's probably not even the biggest moth that you've seen. But what exactly is that? Maybe you could describe it for us and tell us what kind of moth that is.
Yeah, that's a Promethea moth, and that's in the family called the Saturniidae, the giant silkworm moths. And those are amazing because obviously they're beautiful to look at. And another weird fact about them is that as adults, those moths don't even have a mouth. They don't eat at all. So all the nutrition that they take in, they take in their larval or caterpillar stage. So when people are always like, oh, moths chew through clothes, these can't even do that.
So I'm confused by this, and I wanted to ask you about this. I've heard about a few different types of moth species that don't have mouths. So it comes out of being a caterpillar. It's a moth now, but it doesn't have a mouth. It can't take in any of its own nutrition?
No, that's true. And I think the trick is not to separate in your mind so much the larval stage from the adult stage. And just like you or I can store fat in our bodies, moths can do that as well. And so as adults, they just have stored fat left over from that larval stage. And, you know, they don't live very long. So those are some of the shortest lived moths. So they can, I think their max lifespan is probably about 10 days.
Okay. How long is a very long lifespan for a moth species?
Probably a couple of months. And I mean, even in the tropics where they have warm weather, because cold is a limiting factor for them up here, but even the tropics where they have long warm weather, they would have more broods per season, so more life cycles per season rather than longer lives.
I'm John Dankosky. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. And we're talking about moths and Moth Week with Elena Tartaglia. She's assistant professor of biology at Bergen Community College in Paramus, New Jersey. She's co-founder of National Moth Week. You might not have known that it was National Moth Week, but it is. So we're celebrating with her. Let's go to Carol, who's calling from Old Lyme, Connecticut. Hi there, Carol.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm doing well. What's on your mind?
Oh, we have this new visitor to our yard, and we looked it up online, and it's called a hummingbird moth. We had never seen anything like it. We thought it was a baby hummingbird at first, but we noticed it had antennae, and more than two legs. Why are these so different in body shape and other types of morphology, like their wings, than other types of moths that you see?
Great question. Elena?
Oh, I love this question. Thank you. So I actually studied this type of moth for my graduate research, and these moths are mimics. So the one that you saw was probably, it was in the genus Hemeris, and some of those are mimics of hummingbirds, as you saw, and some of them are mimics of bumblebees. And so they kind of look a little bit like both. And these moths are some of the few diurnal or daytime moths. So they are acting as mimics, and they're protecting themselves from their predators that are mainly birds. And so in looking like a hummingbird, most birds probably won't eat a hummingbird. And then the ones that look like bees are actually mimicking something that can sting. And so in looking like bees or birds, they're actually protecting themselves from the fact that there are more predators of them out in the daytime.
You mentioned some of the camouflaging techniques or the ways in which moths can pretend to be a predator. Mm-hmm. What are some of the defense mechanisms that they have? Because there's a lot of predators out there. I'm sure a lot of birds and other things want to eat them. What are some of the really cool defense mechanisms?
Well, some of them are distasteful, just like monarch butterflies are. And if they've got bright colors, many of them do have chemicals in their bodies that make them taste bad. And a lot of the caterpillars will defend themselves by, again, mimicking snakes or by having postures that are just sort of threatening to birds or other predators.
If I wanted to attract moths into my yard, you know, you can talk about different sorts of gardens where you'd attract butterflies. Is it the same sort of thing? Are there types of plant species or other things that you would put in your yard to try to get more moths if indeed that's what you wanted?
Sure. Moths have a proboscis, just like a butterfly does, that straw-like mouth part. And so you want to look for flowers that have a tubular shape that they can drink from. And in addition, since moths are mostly out at night, you want to look for flowers that are open at night and producing nectar at night and are white or light colored so that the moths can see them. Additionally, moth flowers often have a very strong scent to them because moths have a very strong olfactory system. So look for flowers like that, and you should be able to attract moths. And another way that you could attract moths without plants, this is pretty cool, people like this, is that you could mix up some old beer and rotten fruit that you have hanging around and let it ferment for a few days. And then you can paint it on some of your trees, and that will also attract moths as well.
Old beer and rotten fruit.
Yeah.
I got to say, that doesn't sound as much fun as having a nice garden. I mean, truly, that's not necessarily something I'm going to do. Let's go to a call in Denver, Colorado. Reeves is there. Hi, Reeves.
Hi.
Hi. You're on the air. What's your question?
Great. So when I was a young man, I remember standing. I remember there was this huge moth population that just sort of surged. You'd open up your screen door and like 1,000 moths would just sort of fly out. And I remember every morning my dad would go downstairs and there were so many moths in the house. He'd just be standing there vacuuming them out of the air, which is probably poor form for Moth Week. But my big question is, why do we have these huge surges in moth populations every once in a while?
Well, you know, it's a good question. I was telling our director, Charles, before the show, I actually had an experience like this once where I saw just thousands of moths at one time, and then they were all gone by the morning. What happens there? Why does that happen?
Well, that's another great question. And many insect populations, moths included, have what we call boom and bust population cycles. And so some years you get a big boom, and some years you get very few. And it probably, I'm not an expert on this, it's probably dependent on either just random cues or it may be some environmental cues that signal them to have a boom population one year.
Well, I want to thank Elena Tartaglia, who is assistant professor of biology at Bergen Community College in Paramus, New Jersey, co-founder of National Moth Week. If you'd like a how-to guide on collecting moths, head on over to sciencefriday.com/moth. Happy Moth Week. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Do you know what barbecue mode means in space lingo? We unearthed some interesting facts about how the technology used in the Apollo missions helped to influence a lot of future space travel. Check it out at sciencefriday.com/Apollo. BJ Lederman composed our theme music. Our thanks to our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York, Rich Kim, the technical director, Sarah Fishman, and Jack Horowitz at the controls. If you'd like to write us, send your letters to Science Friday, 19 West 44th Street, room 412, New York, New York, 10036. You can also email us, scifry@sciencefriday.com. Ira's back next week in New York. I'm John Dankosky.